Southwest Scotland turning a little bit cloudier for the afternoon, and again a spot or two of rain. A breezy day across Scotland with temperatures reaching highs of around 4 degrees. And that's the forecast.
Thanks a lot, Nina. Now on BBC Radio 4, Hayden Gwynne continues reading from Lucy Hughes Hallett's new biography, which charts the remarkable story of the Italian poet and political agitator Gabriele D'Annunzio, whose exploits in the early 20th century paved the way for Mussolini's rise to power. Now an enemy of the state, D'Annunzio struggles to keep his utopian experiment in the city of Fiume alive.
D'Annunzio read voraciously in several languages. He was adept at reviving neglected ideas whose time had come round again, and he could spot a developing trend at the very moment of its formation. When he saw something that could nourish his intellect drifting by on the current, he would snap at it, pike-like, and swallow it, and send it forth again better expressed. He borrowed, but he also anticipated. Before Freud, he was fully aware of the nature of the excitement he derived from sleek machinery. The prow of a metal warship, he wrote, is a monstrous phallic elongation. Reading Nietzsche in the 1890s, he recognized ideas already implicit in his own work. And in 1888, a full 2 decades before Marinetti proclaimed a ruthless new machine age aesthetic in the Futurist Manifesto, D'Annunzio wrote an ode to a torpedo. He loved motor cars and telephones and aeroplanes and machine guns. Marinetti's manifesto is full of unacknowledged D'Annunzian sentiments, including the notion that civil society was so foul that only war could cleanse it. September 1919. D'Annunzio's march on the port city of Fiume was thrilling. "Behold a beacon lit at the end of the Adriatic," wrote the young Belgian poet Léon Kozhnitsky. Along with the young soldiers, a cosmopolitan host of artists, intellectuals, revolutionaries and romantics were drawn there as to the one bright light in the dreariness of post-war Europe. For decades, D'Annunzio had toyed with visions of dictatorship. His admiration of Plato, whose republic is ruled by all-powerful philosopher kings, his poetic reinvention of Garibaldi as a marmoreal figure, master of the elements and of the mob. His play, Glory, whose hero Flamma is a true man suited to the great emergency, a vast, free human spirit with a great destiny in his eyes. Glory was subsequently much admired by fascists for its apparently miraculous prescience. But D'Annunzio, in writing it, was not prophesying the coming of Mussolini. He was creating a role for himself. January 1920. Having ignored the vote by the people of Fiume that accepted by approximately 4-1 the terms offered by the Italian Prime Minister, terms which would have guaranteed their right to decide their own destiny and meant D'Annunzio's expulsion, D'Annunzio wrote to Dante, his gondolier and factotum at the Casetta Rossa, asking for a further supply of his favourite Fiat chocolates and a pot of lotion for his fingernails. He was staying put. Here the new forms of life are not only conceived, but are fulfilled. D'Annunzio was creating a space in which those new forms could flourish, and where the most unlikely alliances could be attempted. Socialists, anarchists, syndicalists, communists, futurists, and some of those who had begun earlier that year to call themselves fascists congregated there. Representatives of Sinn Féin and of nationalist groups from India and Egypt arrived, discreetly followed by British agents. It was time, D'Annunzio declared, for sparks from the Holocaust of Fiume to ignite desires of revolt the world over. It became difficult for D'Annunzio to go out alone. The minute he set foot outside the governor's palace, a shout would go up, a crowd would gather. Immured by his celebrity, he created a den for himself and his beloved greyhounds in his apartments. His bedroom was hung about with banners and military standards. There was a table covered with flasks of perfume. There was a couch heaped with cushions on which he stretched out to allow his imagination to play, or on which he and Luisa Baccara enjoyed ultimate voluptuousness, their lovemaking shown back to them by a strategically placed mirror. Often, when he was conferring with his ministers, ostensibly intent on logistics or diplomacy, or quick-marching his soldiers over hills, his mind, or so he told Luisa, was in these intensely private rooms. More anniversaries celebrated with rallies and shouting, with legionaries marching with laurel branches in their rifles, and with D'Annunzio on his balcony whipping up a storm of hero worship and martial ardour. But the days of wine and sugared rose petals were drawing to a close. In March, D'Annunzio had to tell Luisa that there were no flowers in Fiume, that his vases all stood empty. Basic foods were rationed, and even when provisions were available in the shops, the workers often had no money to buy them. To demonstrate his solidarity with the hungry troops, D'Annunzio put on the uniform of a humble corporal and took his place in a ration queue for a photo call. In June, the Italian Prime Minister Francesco Nitti fell from power. His successor, Giolitti, ignoring D'Annunzio, entered into negotiations with Yugoslavia. If most of the city's pre-war industries were temporarily defunct, one form of production was still lively, the manufacture of hand grenades. Military exercises were conducted with real ammunition and real injuries. The legionaries fought duels with flamethrowers, returning from exercises bloodied and singed. November 1920. The aristocratic English man of letters, Osbert Sitwell, has come to see what the man who has done more for the Italian language than any writer since Dante has made of his city-state. Sitwell finds the streets full of colourful desperados. Every man seemed to wear a uniform designed by himself. Some wore beards and had shaven heads like the commander. Others cultivated huge tufts of hair, half a foot long, waving out from their foreheads, and a black fez at the back of the head. Cloaks, feathers, and flowing black ties were universal, and all carried the Roman dagger. Sitwell succeeds in securing an audience. He passes through a pillared hall full of palm trees in pseudo-Byzantine flower pots, where soldiers lounged and typists rushed furiously in and out. In an inner room, almost entirely covered with banners, he finds two more than life-size carved and gilded saints from Florence, a huge 15th-century bronze bell, and the commandant, as D'Annunzio now likes to be called, in military grey-green, his chest striped with the ribbons of his many medals. He seems nervous and tired, but bald and one-eyed as he is, Sitwell records, "At the end of a few seconds, one felt the influence of that extraordinary charm which has enabled him to change howling mobs into furious partisans." Since Sitwell arrived in Fiume, the great conductor, Arturo Toscanini, has brought his orchestra to the town. To celebrate Toscanini's visit, D'Annunzio lays on a mock battle, which is as lethal as an ancient Roman circus. 4,000 men take part, attacking each other with real grenades. The orchestra, which initially provides a musical accompaniment, Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, becomes involved in the fighting. Over 100 men are injured, including 5 musicians. D'Annunzio, discussing the event with Sitwell, explains that his legionaries are weary of waiting for battle. They must fight one another. But he doesn't really want to talk about the mayhem around him. He is missing the fellowship, not of equals, he does not, in his opinion, have any equals, but of well-informed admirers. He quizzes Sitwell about the new English poets, one of the best of whom is Sitwell's sister, Edith. They talk about Shelley and about English greyhounds. In that same month, the Italian and Yugoslav governments signed the Treaty of Rapallo. Most of what D'Annunzio had been demanding has been granted, but it has been done behind his back. For D'Annunzio, this was not a victory, but a deal. Worse, under its terms, he would be obliged to hand over the government of Fiume and leave. Prime Minister Giolitti sets a deadline. D'Annunzio must leave Fiume with his legion by 6 p.m. on the 24th of December. An amnesty is promised to all those who leave in time. D'Annunzio talks of turning Fiume into his own pyre. He is priming himself and his little army for a fight to the death. But all his rhetoric was based on a false premise. "Fraternal blood shall not be spilt," he said, meaning that a conflict between his legion and Italy was unthinkable. 24th of December. Giolitti's troops take up positions along the frontiers of Fiuman territory and an Italian warship moves into the harbour. The hour appointed comes and goes. That night, the fighting begins. D'Annunzio is ecstatic. He is beyond himself. But for all the fire and noise, it was a half-hearted battle. Officers on both sides threw away the advantage of surprise by calling out warnings to their opponents and begging them not to advance. They didn't want to shoot. In the 3 days of fighting, a total of 33 men were killed. Towards evening on Boxing Day, when sunset, as D'Annunzio noted, was bathing the sea and the skies with blood red, the warship Andrea Doria fires on the governor's palace. A shell slams through a window of D'Annunzio's quarters and explodes in the room below that in which he sits. The windows cave in, plaster falls from the ceiling. D'Annunzio is flung forward and temporarily stunned. According to one witness, he panicked, screaming, "Help! Save me!" Two of his officers, stumbling over the debris, rush to grab hold of him. They hustle him out of the room and down the stairs. The courtyard is crowded with arditi running hither and thither, brandishing daggers, rifles and grenades. Pushing through the melee, D'Annunzio's aides half carry, half drag him to a house safely screened from the waterfront. The shell had been a warning of what might be to come. The mayor, the bishop and members of the National Council come to beg D'Annunzio to save the city and its people by admitting defeat. He hesitates. According to Antongini, his long-serving aide, unable to decide the issue, he tosses a coin. Perhaps he really couldn't make up his mind. Perhaps he preferred to pass some of the responsibility for the humiliating decision onto blind fortune. The tossed coin comes down for capitulation. The people of Fiume are to be spared the awful splendour he had for so long been offering them. The apostle of death and glory chooses ignominy and life. D'Annunzio leaves Fiume on the 18th of January 1921. There is to be no trial, no punishment. The legionnaires depart by the trainload. Even in defeat, D'Annunzio was still an idol. The majority of Fiume's inhabitants may have been relieved to see the last of him, but nonetheless, thousands of them turned out to watch him go. And the leader of Trieste's fascio begged to be allowed to kneel in the dust along the roadside and kiss his hands as he passed by. In one day, he has dwindled from the godlike commandant into a tired old man. That evening, a misty and bitterly cold one, he arrives in Venice to be met by Antongini. Arriving at his apartment, large, gloomy and cluttered with a jumble of stuff salvaged from his various past homes, he goes straight to his room. He has nothing to say. Benito Mussolini has taken his political place, bullying his way to the premiership by marching on Rome in October 1922.
Hayden Gwynn was reading from The Pike, Gabriele D'Annunzio, poet, seducer and preacher of war. The book was abridged by Penny Lester and produced by Gemma Jenkins. For more exclusive content on this week's Book of the Week, including an interview with the author, Lucy Hughes-Hallett, just go to the BBC Radio 4 website. The Shipping Bulletin is next, and to take us there, it's sailing by. And now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Saturday the 26th of January. There are warnings of gales in Viking, North Utsira, White, Portland, Plymouth, Biscay, Lundy, Fastnet, Irish Sea, Shannon, Rockall, Malin, Hebrides, Bailey, Fair Isle, Faroes and South East Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. Low Bailey 981 losing its identity by 1800 on Saturday. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, North Utsira. Southerly or southeasterly 5 to 7. Occasionally gale 8 at first. Rain or snow. Moderate or good. Occasionally very poor. South Utsira. Southerly or southeasterly 5 to 7. Rain or snow. Moderate or good. Occasionally very poor. For